Well, I had this really terrific sermon all about labor, but Barbara said it so much better, and Studs Terkel, I can't top him, so let's forget about that and move on to some other meanings of May Day. May Day, of course, is May. It's springtime, it's light, it's spring, it's hope, it's marching and protesting season again because the winter is really too cold to get up a good march and a good protest, and you want to do it in the warmth of the sun when your heart is filled with hope. But I'm not talking about that. It's also, and the giveaway was, May Day, May Day, help! And it comes from the French, May Day, because we can't spell it in French. I actually suspect that the French can't spell it in French either. But so we've made it into May Day, and it means May Day. Help me, help me. We're drowning. And as I look around our world and I look around our society, I have these times when I just want to scream, help. Now, I'm going to be talking today about some highly charged, partisan, political issues. But I'm not talking about the issues themselves. We're not taking positions on that part, but about how is it that we see our world, each other, and the people with whom we engage in some important issues, and are there any principles to our conversations? It's very easy, and I have myself watched the news and read the paper and kept my NPR implant fine-tuned into my ear and gotten discouraged watching all of the poisonous partisan bickering that's been going on in Iraq. They had an election. That should end the bickering. But it doesn't seem to have. 3 months after an election that was going to change everything, they are still talking. After announcing that there was a new cabinet, which was one of those things that was 100% half true, there was a new cabinet, but it really didn't include the once dominant Sunnis, who are not part of the game. They are still talking. They are still bickering. They are still fighting about ethnic proportional representation. And we look at them, I suspect, and ask, how can it be that they are fiddling with this minutia of narrow special interests while their country burns? It's not Rome that's burning. It's Iraq. It's Baghdad. It's Basra. It's Mosul. It's all of that country going to a noisy, damaging, dangerous, deadly hell, while politicians sit in relative safety and talk about their narrow issues. Why can't they see the bigger picture? There's a country, there's a polity. Well, I start to shake my head and in wonderment at their ignorance and selfishness and narrowness, and then I think of why is it that I see this mote in their eye and not the log in our own when I look at our American squabbling and fighting and the toxicity of our conversation and, for me, the lack of principle involved in what are important political and partisan issues. I am not saying that the issues are not important, and I am not saying that we should not engage the entire panoply, if you can say plethora, I can say panoply, the entire panoply of political issues with passion, but also with some sense of rhetorical proportion. And I'm not seeing the rhetorical proportion in Iraq, nor am I seeing it in our partisan conversations. Oh, goodness, the issue of faith. Now, given the business I'm in, I'm not going to come out against faith. given the fact that our currency is not on a gold standard, we have faith-based economy. Faith is a terrific thing. People of faith can be terrific, but when the faithful stand opposite each other, with each with only one true faith, and smear the other, I lose faith in our ability to carry on a civil conversation. I think the choices are between political comity, with a T, or societal tragedy. And I think that we're heading for a terrible, terrible food fight. Americans, in my view, should be looking at Iraq and learning what the road to hell looks like when we segregate ourselves into these narrow and angry senses of, you know, what's called identity politics, where we identify on one or two issues, whether it's religion, and that can be any particular religion, or whether it is one single issue, and then demonize everybody who disagrees with us. The political rhetoric is, in my view, instructive. Let's see, what's the big conflict going on now? It's about judges, and it's going to be about the nuclear option versus the constitutional option. Now, that's to imply that the nuclear option done by the Republicans make the Republicans terrorists, and the constitutional option opposed by the Democrats make the Democrats anti-constitutional. Great. That really gets most of the Republicans and Democrats. That's not at all true. It's just not true when you look at the mainstream of any of our two major political parties, the spectrum of which is extraordinarily narrow. People talk about the far left and the far right. We don't have a far left. Well, we got Jim. But, I mean, other than that, we don't have a far left. There isn't a far left. When Republicans start talking about the loony left, they're way past Jim. Jim is mainstream. We don't have a far right. If you're trying to bridge the intellectual left and right in this country, way back in the 1950s, Mort Saul observed that Eisenhower was for moderate integration and Stevenson was for gradual integration. And he wondered, is there nowhere between these two great extremes that we can't find compromise? Well, these are still the same. You know, is there nowhere between Michael Kinsley and George Will that we can't sit down and have some tea with our pinkies extended? I mean, if you want to go to more interesting people, I suppose you can go to Buchanan on one side and Sharpton on the other and at least be entertained by it. But the mainstream of political discourse in this country is not very wide, and the amount of toxic, polemical argumentation and feigned horror at the other side is really pretty remarkable. I've been looking at the great issues and the great principles behind the great issues over the past 50, 60 years. And you know something? Our deeply held political principles are, how can I put this genteelly, operationally very flexible. Let me explain. World War II. The conservatives were America first isolationists. The liberals said, get involved. Vietnam. The conservatives said, let's get out there and save all these people in Southeast Asia. And the liberals said, whoa, Nellie, let's not get involved. During the Clinton era, liberals were saying, there are terrible things going on in Africa. Let's get involved. And the conservatives said, no, America first. Let's not get involved. Now in Iraq, conservatives are saying, there's pain and suffering out there. There was a terrible dictator to get rid of. Let's get involved. And liberals are saying, no, no, it's not really our business. Let's not get involved. The principle seems to be highly flexible. It has got to be jarring for some people in this room to hear Democrats sing the praises of the filibuster. I mean, you know, I understand why, but when you grow up hearing Democrats, for the most part, conservative Democrats, using the filibuster to stop every piece of civil rights legislation and public housing and open housing legislation, you got to go, gee, I'm kind of uncomfortable with this position. But now, Democrats from the South who were for states' rights are now Republicans who are against states' rights. Well, the Democrats are talking about states' rights, and the Republicans, now that they're in power, are it's like when you're in power, the idea of term limits become less and less attractive. And now the Republicans are the new Federalists. I'm not arguing the virtues or vices of any of these positions, but your head has got to spin if you're trying to keep track of them. Only 6 years ago, when Democrats were trying to get judges nominated, the Republicans wouldn't let them out of committee. And the Democrats were saying, the least you can do is they deserve an up or down vote. The nominee for the head of the Civil Rights Administration never got an up or down vote, and the Democrats are saying, at least give them an up and down vote. Today, the Republicans are saying, these are good judges, at least give them an up or down vote, and the Democrats are saying, not so fast. Whose ox is being gored seems to be the number one eternal principle of politics, and the demonizing of the adversary as being a terrorist. If you're religious, you're Taliban. If you're not religious, you're godless. There's a race for faith. We used to have a missile gap with the Soviet Union. Now there is a tremendous God gap that the Democrats have discovered, and Democrats are flocking to churches. Democratic candidates are flocking to churches and becoming members of the flock, because you cannot be unreligious. You have to be a person of faith. An unconstitutionally broad category, incidentally. What is a person of faith? And that's a whole other discussion. But one of the most dangerous things we have in American politics right now is the winners of the American lottery believing that they are the oppressed. That when you see people in the conservative Christian coalition saying they won't let any person of faith get a job, we're oppressed, we're hated, we're ridiculed, it's very dangerous to have the powerful believe that they are the victims. And it's another wonderful principle that is highly flexible, and that is the conservative Christians who hate it when people of color and when women say, we're missing something in the American dream. They say, oh, it's your sense of victimhood. I can't stand it. Now they have found their sense of victimhood, and they are part of that great national food fight that we're having. And there are no eternal principles behind these arguments. They are as changeable as political opportunism. And what it has in common with what is going on in Iraq is it is the narrow partisanship of it's not enough to win. You must humiliate and vanquish the opponent. It is we have gotten so good at spin and political positioning that we are able to put these issues in areas of good and evil, which is not a helpful way to have a decent conversation, my way is God's way and your way is the way of the devil. That's really destructive. Every time I try to use that argument at home, it leads to sleeping on the couch, actually. And that's pretty much where it's going to lead in this country, with us sleeping on separate couches and not having a sense of being in this together, able to carry on a genuine conversation instead of being terrified of saying a phrase that can be taken as the wrong soundbite and used against you and your party and your people and your ideas. We do not have in this country a culture of trust where we can talk to each other. We've got serious issues as a society. But if you're running for office, you better be careful not to say anything. Watch a congressional hearing. These people hold up their hands and swear to tell the truth. Democrats, Republicans, anywhere in between, and their job is to say nothing. Now, this starts out, which is very interesting for people of faith, because they take an oath. Well, not on our hymnal, but they take an oath on something holy, and they take an oath and they promise that they are going to tell the truth. And as people of faith, you expect them to tell the truth. And I certainly believe that Clarence Thomas, when he put his hand on that Bible and swore that he had never given Roe v. Wade any thought at all, was not taking that oath as a strict constructionist, okay? And I think that when Clinton put his hand on that Bible and said, I was only kidding, and I'm not quite sure what the meaning of is, that he was doing the same kind of dance. We can talk about that faith, but operationally, we know we're kidding. We know that an oath is not an oath, that a position is not a position, that the rhetoric that we use is out of proportion to our differences. And that's really important. A couple of months ago when we had Jonathan Kirsch here and he was talking about the development of the change from polytheism to monotheism, and he talked about some of those sects, those Arian sects versus some Nicene sects, and these tiny differences in terms of how people theologically understood a nuance of theological, Christological difference that would have meant nothing to anyone in terms of how they actually practiced their life, but those tiny differences became the organizing principles for people to kill each other. I have looked at the future of Iraq and of identity politics and where it leads. When we categorize each other by of faith, not of faith. When we categorize each other as Taliban, godless atheists. When we look for proportionality and try to fit in every position instead of sitting with some kind of respect and having the kinds of conversations across a relatively narrow spectrum that could actually lead to statesmen and stateswomen doing things for the good of the larger polity. It is a cautionary tale, not so much about war, but about what it takes to constitute a nation. As we watch the Iraqis labor to bring forth a nation out of people who have identified for years by religion, ethnicity, and tribe. They have a lot to overcome. It is a cautionary tale from which we should learn about political comity in our society so that it does not lead to that kind of societal tragedy. Food fight or conversation? Those are the options. Food fights are more entertaining. They make better television, but they don't make for a more goodly nation.